The following interview is with Lori Carlson of Wanakee, Wisconsin, June 10th, 1983. The interviewer is Kathy Coberly of the State Historical Society. Mr. Carlson, who was a progressive for many years and later became a Democrat, is still very active in politics, and we are going to talk about the period of time between approximately 1940 and 1950 when the Progressive Party folded and the Democratic Party became the new home for Wisconsin's liberals. Well, Lori, you were telling me which assemblyman, which Democratic assemblyman in your day were liberal, or you would classify as being liberal supporters.
There may have been someone in the 37th session. I don't even have my rule book. I'm having that clipped. But the I gave you Zimney. Then there was this fellow from Milwaukee. I can't give his name, but he was another Democrat that they got to vote for Alfonsi for speaker, and he was given a chairman excise and fees. And I wouldn't listen to him, and I could throw an elephant. Now here's Van Gilder. He is possibly living. You know, he is 95, 97, or 98 years old. Whether he's living, but I've never heard that he has passed on. And I've inquired. Here's Tien.
Now, what were your feelings about Tien? You indicated that you felt he was
only
liberal under certain circumstances.
He wasn't a true liberal. I mean, I always figured when that judgeship was coming up, his votes changed a great deal more towards the liberal. So I never did consider him a pathological liberal. That's my expression for in blood.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, believe it or not, Thompson, who is speaker, voted for the progressive speaker in 1935, and a fellow named Douglas voted. He was from Waukesha County. He was Republican. He voted for either for 35 or for Alfonsi in 37. But the I don't see any of these here, but I said you couldn't find five
liberals in the
liberals
old Democratic Party.
In the old Democratic Party. They were, you see, the thing would happen, the defeat of Hoover in 32, well, it made the Republican Party was mud. I mean, people were hungry and, you know, almost like it is not with some people, only they don't realize it. But anyway, the La Follettes were in a dilemma. Now, nobody's ever told me this is my... They couldn't run as a Republican because the Republican Party was at a low ebb. You couldn't be elected as a Republican in 34. Well, you had a Democratic sweep in the state. The Chapo was, who defeated Senator Blaine, was defeated by F. Ryan Duffy for the Senate. And some of these guys were elected to the Senate, they put their name down, they didn't know they were supposed to go to Washington or go to Madison. That's how they put their names on tickets, because they hadn't elected a since 1891, they had a Democrats elected, because under the La Follettes from the, you know, before the turn of the century, everything was settled in the primary. It was a Republican and the stalwarts, and this was, they were, a Republican was not as a Republican as we know it. They were different in the day and light. So they had to make a choice. I was running a Democrat. You had a Democrat as governor, Schwedemann, who had the good wishes of FDR. And here Bob LaFalle was up. That wasn't pointed out that day, but he was up for election too. So FDR gave Bob LaFalle his blessing in Green Bay in 1934. Well, that rubbed off on Phil, and Phil won by about 20,000 votes in 34, but Bob won very handily. So I say it helped not only Bob, but it helped Phil. But the margin of victory, but we did not elect about 48 progressive assemblymen. What a difference is now, you got 57 up there. Jesus, we had one vote margin. We could have, you had to be there and you had to vote right. Or, you know, you go down the drain. This guy, Naraki, he was from Milwaukee. He was a Democrat. He was a liberal. McParland, fairly good. It was his first term, but I mean, I'm thinking of the people that were in there for three terms, like I was.
Mm-hmm.
And the lobbyists were courting the Democrats, and they decided to be as conservative as the Republicans because they didn't know any difference. They didn't. Roosevelt was just it was nice to say I was for Roosevelt because he was popular, but they were not. So I think it was the decision of the LaFollettes to run. It was a practical thing to do, and to get elected, you're no good if you don't get elected. Mm-hmm. So they went to Fond du Lac in May of 1934, they decided to organize this party. They had to have so many names. I circulated, I don't know how many petitions, but I went out and I circulated. I must have gotten four or five. There were 20 on each one, so it took quite a bit of work to go out in the rural area and get these names. And I had no intentions of running for the legislature, but I think what prompted me was I was very much interested in the vocational agriculture, vocational work, and I figured our secondary system was it wasn't in keeping, it wasn't doing anything. I mean, it was merely preparatory for colleges.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't to give the kid that wanted to start out in business or a farm or a woodwork or something they could do. And they were pretty nasty with me. I remember my tape, I'll just repeat it. He says, well, another one of those radical LaFalle ideas, you know. Oh, I think, I says, Joe Mallory, you're the radical, I'm the conservative. I want people to learn how to make a living. So
nothing real radical about that.
No, I don't think so. So I decided to run. I guess it was sort of in my blood that I sometime wanted to do it, and so I went on and ran. My dad said, well, you're crazy. You can't make it. And and I remember the superintendent of school, the Washburn, says to me, he says, what the hell are you running for? I says, none of your goddamn business. That's what I told him. That's the way I put it. And Bob Nixon, who is the floor leader of the progressives in 31, when they had a 65 to whatever it was, majority.
Mm-hmm.
He was a floor leader and a very fine fellow. And he called me in and told me to lay off, you know, till after the primary, because he was running for district attorney on the Republican ticket. Bob was as honest as the day was long, but he had loyalty to PV, and it's just like Truman was loyal to the Pettengill, or the, you know, the people in Kansas City. I admire people that stick by their friends if they aren't, you know, dishonest or like, yeah, well, Petey was not dishonest, he just was taking the wrong course. And then there was a gal named Liz Hawks who hated me. You've heard of her, probably.
Yeah, I haven't really found anyone who knows much about her, though.
Could you talk a little bit about her? Oh, yeah, I could talk a lot about her.
I'd like to hear about her.
She was the secretary to Peavy, and she didn't like it because I was espousing the Progressive Party.
Well, is Liz Hawks a Democrat or a
Progressive? No, she's been everything.
Is that right?
Yeah, she was a Republican then, and she was supporting PV. She was on the Republican ticket. I mean, she was supporting or working for PV. And then in 1940, she ran as a Republican for district attorney and defeated Walter Norlin, who had run on the Republican ticket in 36, and when Bob Nixon was resigned to go to the Public Service Commission, he was appointed. Well, he was a starving lawyer, and there were not many lawyers in the county to appoint. You know, and there was one fellow in Ashland who wanted to get the job, but I didn't want to go outside of the county. So I had him appointed a district attorney, and he was elected in 38, but Liz Hawks beat him in the primary, Republican primary of 1940. And then he turns around and runs on both tickets, and I was all the county ticket ran on both tickets. You could in those days, and I said, hell, I'm not going to run the Republican ticket, and if I had run, I could have won both of them, but I decided I wasn't going to run on a Republican ticket, but I was left all alone. But Norlin beat Liz Hawks in the primary of 42 for a district attorney, and then in 44 she ran for attorney general in the state of Wisconsin. I remember I met Cadigan, who's a lawyer, Democratic lawyer for Superior, and says, "Well, you're going to vote for Liz Hawks." I said, "Like hell I am." But she didn't like me. She called me a promising young upstart, and I thought that was pretty good.
How would you characterize Liz Hawks' political?
She didn't know where the hell she was. She was, I gave it to Gaylord for every pointer. She didn't know where she was. She was not a liberal. She was a, you know, if she ever got appointed to the Board of Regents, I don't know. I think this Merchart's about the same way. If I get to see the governor, I'm going to tell her she doesn't carry any political weight. Merchart, it was just appointed to a big job down here. But Liz had been all over the spectrum, but she got active in Democratic politics up in the 10th District after 44, and she never did get elected, but she kept on. I think she ran a couple of times for Attorney General of State. She never did win a primary. But
when you say she was all over the map, do you mean she was
politically?
She was an opportunist?
Opportunist, I would call her.
Would you?
We very much were an opportunist. She, then of course, when the Democrats came into the fold in 1950, I say, or 48,
mm-hmm.
48 and then 50 on, of course I was very close to, Bill Proxmire. I was the second guy to know him. I was very close to Bill Evue, and walked out of his office, and he walked in first, and I'm the second guy to meet him, and of course, I thought Bill was, Bill wanted to come here with the express idea of getting into politics, and I was pretty close to Bill because I was a pretty close, I was probably as close as anyone to Bill Evue.
How did you first get to know Bill Evieux? How did you become so closely associated with
him? This goes back to, I went out and started the Progressive Party in Bayfield County. So I dealt with, I had conversations and mail from Tom Davlin. Tom Davlin took an interest in me. So I got into this group. I was the only young fellow. And let's go back to 35. I was only 27 years old. And the rest of these guys were Colonel Hand, he was a secretary to old Bob. I mean, so I would, and Lawrence Quiddit, who was speaker 15 and 17, very good friend. I played bridge with these people, you know, and I played bridge with them every night. Colonel Charlie Dow, who was the personal secretary to Philip Fowler, he was a very close friend of mine. So they took an interest in me, and they liked me, and I wasn't a guy to, when you get with older people, don't shoot off your mouth, just listen, you know. I wasn't trying to be a smarty aleck. So I was accepted. I was the only young guy accepted, and of course, this had Miles and McMillan didn't like it because I was the, you know, I was in, and there were a lot of people who were envious of my position, but I didn't, I wasn't an apple polisher, or call a brown noser. And I worked for Bill Evieux Station, and I wouldn't tell him nothing because it would get in the paper or to get back to the station, or I just never told him anything. Had I done it, I would have been in a very good position today, but I'm not built that way. And I was never a tattletale in school, and I wasn't going to be, you know. And he often asked me if I would,
Bill Evieux,
what's going on at the station? And I said, well, you've got enough relatives out there. You see, the Stevensons were first cousins. They both died last turn of the year. Art Stevenson and George Stevenson both died. They were first cousins of William T. Evieux. Mm-hmm. But he sort of dropped them, you know. And I figured, I won't go into this. We'll continue where we want to. I could probably get into some of that later.
Yeah, well, Evieux was really so important.
Well, Evieux was there.
Maybe I could ask you this. I know that during the early 40s, he did switch and become a Democrat, or at least he began realizing that that was the best way to support liberal causes. And is this true?
Well, he took a very, in 38, he took a very decided dim view of Philip Fowler's organizing the National Progressive America. And I didn't like it either because I was for FDR. I still maintain the FDR like Bob, and I think if Phil had, but Phil thought that FDR took the Wisconsin idea, took all the Follis ideas, and made the New Deal of it. And I think there was a feeling, damn it, these are, and we're not getting credit for it, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think there was just sort of a personal thing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite close to Phil. I'd drive him to work, and when he was out of office, he'd write me, and we were very close. But Phil, the trouble with Phil, if he'd have been 4 years older than he was too young, and he was ambitious, and he Bob was the he was the excitable type, or he was smoother than Phil. Mm-hmm. Phil was more to the point. He was quite brusque, and if he'd have had 4 or 6 years of maturity, I think he'd have been a lot better off. He never did get over. Some people recover. He recovered once from his defeat in 32, but then he after his defeat in 38, he never did could recover. He, of course, he'd made some mistakes. He backed MacArthur, he was a personal friend of MacArthur, and he was in the service, and that dug him a little bit further in the corner.
And you think these were the reasons why F.U. got discouraged with him?
Well, it was that, yeah. And he took, F.U. had an idea, he would take, that he, F.U. had an idea that he was harder on people that were in office than they were his opposition. I mean, he was tough on Blaine. He was tough on Phil. He was tough on Phil. But he'd give credit to Johnny Come Lately, guy that had a few liberal votes. And he did with a fellow that had an outstanding record of continuous liberal views. And F.U. was not as liberal as, he was liberal until it come to his own pocketbook. He supported labor, but not for labor in his own organization. I know that because he didn't like the guild, or he didn't like when they organized the, when he organized the announcers and the engineers out of WIV, I was there then, and I said, "Why the hell don't you?" And I always spoke frankly to F.U., and I think he liked me for it. "Why the hell don't you give some bonus to your?" I said, "You aren't paying him a terrific big salary. Give him a bonus at the end of the year. We got a $25 a year bonus when it, Christmas time."
Mm-hmm.
Well, I said, "If you know all you want, you should have given to the government." Well, he could have. They wouldn't have. Why do people organize? Because they're unhappy. They figure they're making money, and they should. So they organize. And he didn't like. He liked organized labor until it came to his own newspaper or his own radio station. Mm-hmm. And. This came from Bill Walker, who later bought WISM, and he told me this back in 52. He says, well, F.U. had made promises to me when I had chances to manage radio stations and take over businesses here in Madison. And Bill Walker, who used to manage WIBA, he says, "Laurie," he says, Bill thinks you're too much for the employees. So you see, but I wouldn't take any job above anyway, because I had my little moonlighting going on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I figured that he had promised to make me a director and made promises, and I was chasing him around on my own gas, dragging him to Chicago and Duluth and all over hell. And I figured that I'd come to the point where, why should I be doing this? I should be, got kids that are going to college. I said, let's cut out this. I was in every damn thing, Chamber of Commerce, you name it, I was in every damn thing. I said, cut this out and I'm going to start. So I got into, first thing I got into was these warehouses out here. And,
so that's when you started thinking about business on your own?
By myself, yeah. And that was my first one. By the way, John Jonas was, I was in with John Jonas on this because I helped him get a job. You know, Joe Jonas is he's a guy that they had a big fuss about, who appointed Dreyfus as president of Century Insurance.
Oh, yes, yes.
Well, I got John Jonas' job with a highway job in 1936, and five more other fellows that I got jobs for, and that's how they got down here to go to school. Of course, he would not admit it today, but because I had a good drag with the contractor, because I was working with a highway commission, and that's how I.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's a question for you. getting back to the progressives and the Democrats, you mentioned on this, on your other tape, that you thought that the progressives going Republican, when Bob went Republican in 46, you think that that set back the cause of liberalism for, you said, for 12 years.
Well,
what makes you say that?
Well, I think it set it restarted. You see, if Loomis had been elected or had lived, he was going to run as a Republican in 44. That's the story that I get from the people, and they were going to back the Republican Party. And when Bob decided to run for Senate seat, he knew he was going to run against McCarthy, and the Democratic Party had just never gone, had taken the state. They had taken as far as county offices, but never only once has it happened, and in a half a century, that was in 32, so he figured that he had a great deal of encouragement from a lot of leading Republicans, and they turned on him. And then, of course, they wanted to get rid of LaFalle. I think there were some that were sincere that wanted him to come into the Republican Party, but he stayed in Washington to on this reorganization.
I guess what I'm getting at is a lot of the progressives who were liberal did end up going with the Democrats anyway, even though Bob went with the LaFalle, with the Republicans. So I was wondering if it really set it back all that far. What do you think?
Well, I think it did. There were some that felt that way. Where I came from, Superior, they went along with Bob, you know, lock, stock, and barrel. It was, I don't know, they felt LaFalle was, this is how they got there, this is how they're going to...
Was that pretty much true all over that
Milwaukee,
that area?
Yes.
Speaking of the Superior...
Rural northern Wisconsin went along with Bob and going with the Republican. Milwaukee... Or I should say more, the labor element and the socialist element were very opposed. And I think that that was a big mistake that we ever went with the, consolidated with the socialists back in 36, because it was a tail wagging the dog. I think they did more damage to the, progressives were an unusual type of people. They were, I can take my sphere, of people that I know, they may all make over $50,000 a year, including myself. And they're liberals. Well, you get, it's more in our blood, but I mean, you take the business, there were a lot of people who had money in those days that were for Bob or followed, because and they had money to back him up, but then when they bring the socialists in, they were for laissez-faire. They were for we wanted to make the capitalist system work. This was their idea, because a poor guy couldn't run for the legislature back in those days at $500 for 2 years. So we lost a lot of support. Mm-hmm. Especially in the small town and the small businessmen, who figured, well, they were going to get them, and then of course,
What do you think would have been different if Bob had gone Democratic?
I think Bob would have had a tough time making it in 48 if he'd run, because it took a while. I couldn't get over quite see the Democrats too much, because of, I could see FDR just like nothing, but
sure.
Statewide, I just didn't have I couldn't see them very much. So
you think most of the progressives then, or at least in your area, felt like the Democrats were just the conservative Democrats that
well,
you
they
used
were,
to know
they were,
about?
They were conservative. They often had candidates, but they were never got anywhere up north.
Were you in contact at all, the people up north, with, say, some of the people in Madison and Milwaukee, like Dan Hone and Jerry Clifford, and the people who had, the liberals who had gone with the Democrats and were genuine liberals?
Well, I think that Dan Hone, of course, was a socialist who turned Democrat. He was a Tommy Duncan. You know who Tommy Duncan was. He was he was one of the very sharp guy. He was one of the ones that got us into this socialist thing. And I'm great for it, but you got to do it by little bites. You can't go on and look what's happening in France today. They're getting all. And you got to go by evolution with this stuff. You can't go by decree or legislation. You can't.
For instance, did say in 45, 46, was there any contact with Milwaukee, Madison organizers up there, trying to organize get Democrats on the ticket, liberal Democrats?
There was some, but not a great deal. But of course, I was teaching school in Superior then, and I sort of gotten away from the body. I was still active in, you know, sponsoring. I tried to get Phil Nelson to run against Okonski in 30.
Right, I've got a question.
Okay. My daughter's up north. Well, no, there wasn't. In 46, we went to Portage and disbanded the Progressive Party, and there was activity there to go in with the Democrats, but they were in a minority and they were outvoted.
Do you remember who was sort of in charge of this activity?
It was pretty much the Milwaukee contingent. It was more or less the Milwaukee labor and some of the labor forces that didn't want to go into the Republican Party. The Democrats that they fused did the progressives go with the what's called? Well, they were those that were never.
Yeah, you were talking about the Portage Convention in 46, when the progressives disbanded,
right,
and the fact that there were some Milwaukee labor backers there trying to talk Democrat.
Democrat, I wouldn't say, but to me, I can't remember all, you know, who they were, because people get up and talk.
Sure. Were there any Madison people that you remember?
Yes, there were some Madison people. I can't think of any who were. Madison was pretty much, they were pretty much Lafalgar, you know, minded about staying in the Republican Party, or, you know, going back to the Republican Party. But they, it lost by a fairly substantial majority. But it did build a schism.
So it actually came to a vote?
Yes, it came to a vote, and I forget what it was, but it was fairly substantial, because of the Progressive Party was a Lafalgar Party. Let's not lose mind of that. Now, here's something that I brought up in my previous tape, and I'm vain enough as an organizer of this. Mrs. Lafalgar called me one of the best organizers in the state. We had starting with 36, 38, 40, we'd have meetings all over the county, in every town hall, and we'd get to the people. In 38, we were the only county in the state that showed an increase for Phil Lafalgar, which tells me something, that we got to the people. And I've tried to get the Democratic Party to do this, you know, to have meetings there, or we call them town meetings. Get people together and talk about these things. And we'd have as many as 16 or 17 meetings throughout the county, and I think it bore fruit. In 1940, we kept up And we openly endorsed Roosevelt in 1936 in my county, and also 1940. So but now there were a lot of these loose. Now there was in this town, Glenn Roberts, who was chairman of the party one time. Bill Hobbins, who is he just died recently. He was head of the American Exchange Bank. But you had a lot of these guys that were, I call them money progressives. They were, they figured there was something in for him. I don't know, I just had that feeling. And then there was a guy named Padgett who came down here starving, and he turned Republican. He ran for Congress and was defeated by Lester Johnson. And, this is a sideline. I do have you up to Minneapolis in 19, right after Merlin Hull died. In fact, his body was in state in Black River Falls, and he says, who do you know in Black River Falls? It's Lester Johnson. Let's stop and see him. So we found him, and he was chief clerk in 1935 and 37, the assembly. He was going to law school, and so we stopped and visited with him, and Edgar said, I'm making it short, he said, run for Congress. He said, oh, sure. He said, hell, I can't make it. He said, Jackson County was the only county that that went Democratic. He said, you go ahead and run, you'll win. And he ran, and I saw him 4 or 5 years later, and Lester said, you know, if it hadn't been for that, for Ebu telling me to run, I wouldn't have run. You know, so it did, I see it had an effect. But getting back to another thing, in 1946, I figured I could organize the 10th district, and there was nothing for it. I called Tom Davin, who was running the Progressive campaign. Now, whether I called him or wrote him, you know, people didn't make long distance calls in those days. It cost too damn much money. You know? And I think I wrote him. I think it over, but I said, if you'll just pay me a little expenses, you know, I wasn't making a hell of a lot of teaching school. I said, I'll organize the 10th district. And Tom either wrote or called me and said, it looks pretty good for Bob. But I am vain enough to think that when I go after something, I go after it. I call it medicine ball, I go after it. I hit it hard. That I could have changed 2,500 votes. And
you think you could have?
I really believe that we wouldn't have had Joe McCarthy to live with in this state or this country. So I'm vain enough to say it. And
your district could have made the difference?
The district.
If it had been organized properly?
Could have organized properly.
Who organized it? There was no effort made?
There was no. You see, the LaFalle organization was not, you know, as we know it today, organized. I mean, you didn't have all these smooth things going up in the legislature. And you had people, not only, you had the Legislative Reference Library tell you you give them an idea and they put it down on a bill. But now they had researched everything and they got everything, and we didn't have any, secretaries. They couldn't type. They make mistakes. So I wrote my own letter longhand. Hell, and then I had a box. That was my plunder box. Was the only thing I had all my worldly possessions in. Here now, the Crabs, they got a big office, and so there wasn't much organization. No money from down there or to come up and organize. It was pretty much done by the county or by the precinct. And it was pretty hard to get money from people in those days. The people that were progressives were pretty down out, and they couldn't afford to give you a 5-spot or a 10-spot.
Mm-hmm.
So the people in the people that were progressives, they all went, most, I would say 90-95% of them went into the Democratic Party. But
at which, at what point did this happen in your
district? I think in 1948 it started. You see, when Rennebaum defeated General Immel in the primary, we got the notice that we were no longer wanted in the Republican Party. Starting with 48, Immel was the progressive and he was sort of a half-assed one, excuse my language. Then in 50, Carl Thompson ran he knew he couldn't win, and then, but Bill Proxmire talked to me, he wanted to run for office, and I told him about my experience that the best way and to win is just go out and meet people, and that's what I did, and I always say in spite of or because I hate to say this, when a guy's got as high as he is, and here I am. But that's how I campaign, and that's how I just call on people, and that's what he did. And if in spite of or because of, I use that term, I can never make. But I was pretty close to Bill, and I worked in his campaigns in 52, 56, and 52, 54, 56, and then in the special election, I worked in his office part-time when I was working with WIVA. But
so you think it was about 48 that people in rural areas, particularly up in your district, began to leave the Republicans?
And well, what they did, they vote in the primary for the, like they voted in the primary for, in 1946, and then 48. Well, then, it just like then, of course, it came to the general election. They voted for the Democrats. So it was, but then in 50, it started to take over. They were forgetting about, and I don't recall, but there wasn't any progressive running as a Republican in 1950. Now, if my memory is correct, you might check that.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't any, we had sort of given up the ghost, we were going to go into the Democratic Party. So it was this group of young progressives, Carl Thompson for Tom Fairchild, McMillan and John Lawton, who actually, pushing. They were, I think, the driving force of saying, let's look here now, let's liberalize the Democratic Party.
Did they have any impact up
I think
north?
They,
or did,
well, they had
pretty
impact.
Much, you were in Madison by
yeah.
this time.
No, I wasn't, I was in Madison in 1948, but this is about the time, but I was too busy trying to make a living. I just, during the years there.
Yeah.
Trying to, but in 1950, but I say I was close to Edview and close to the spirit of what was going on. And of course, what was thought of in Madison generally went out through the state, outside of Milwaukee. They did not have much effect in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty much through the socialists or the labor contingent in Milwaukee. We did not persuade too much. There has always been a little feeling that Milwaukee, the big giant in Madison, the thoughts came from Madison, I think.
Well, speaking of Milwaukee, you mentioned that you knew Andy B. Miller?
Very well.
How did you come to know him?
Well, I served 3 terms in the legislature with him.
I see. What type of a man was he?
Andy was a very strong-willed person. And, for instance, in 39, when they repealed the Little Wagner Act, I got up and spoke for 3/4 hour, and I had a stiff neck, if you know what that is, and try to talk, and I spoke 3/4 hour, giving them You know, I don't have a single organized labor in my district, but I'm against this bill. I said, what labor did to unorganized cheese factories. This was, I contend, was the communist. When I say communist, I mean it. Like Ned Sparks, there was quite a contingent of commies in the labor movement at that time, as there was in Detroit. And they came up to see me, and 38, they were supporting Hamley for senator, and I was supporting, can't think of his name now. He was lieutenant governor, he was appointed by Phil. Anyway, communist or the I don't use it like the people you know, like Joe McCarthy used. Mm-hmm. I mean, these people were active. They were actively in the help defeat Bob Afoud in 46, and they didn't want to. See, if you don't know it, the communists like the Republicans, they like the conservatives, because they figure that the country will fall apart. They figure the progressives or the liberals will do something to make this capitalist system work. So they don't like it. They sooner get it so everybody's unemployed, and then that's where they can step in. I mean, this is...
Mm-hmm.
So that was their feeling of... we were quite dormant in politics from the year of... From 48 until 56 was mm-hmm. a year of nothing. I mean, Proxmire ran and mm-hmm. did a pretty good job in 56. what turned to be...
What about B. Miller? You were talking about B. Miller.
Okay.
A little Wagner.
So he said,
I got curious about that story.
Okay, he said that I wish you'd have a stiff neck more often. I mean, of course, we didn't have speakers on the air. You didn't have the acoustics in there, and I bellered out. And I felt pretty good about it, Andy. And then in 41, I voted against him as our floor leader, because I thought they were leading us into this socialist idea with Milwaukee socialism. And not that I'm against it, but I say you can't do it that way.
You felt they were going too fast?
Going too fast, and you can't. Andy, I don't think ever forgave me for it. And I just felt I supported a fellow from up in Juneau County, was a progressive. He later turned Republican and was Speaker too. Can't think of it now. And but B. Miller was he was a very strong character, very, very strong speaker. But I say he and I sort of parted the ways from 41 on. And but I just felt that he was trying to lead us into an abyss that was never going to get the progressives back into power, whether it be with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party. And of mm-hmm. course, we know that we weren't going to follow the Republican Party anymore, because they didn't want us, and so what was...
I see.
What McCarthy, who was the darling of the Republicans, they lived to see what an albatross he was, starting with 54 when he was disowned by his own party. And when he died, a lot of the intelligent Republicans, a lot of the what you call common sense Republicans, joined the Democrats. We got a lot of people. I say
so
we got a lot of people who first of all, just abhorred McCarthy. I have friends in this town who were Republicans. Get out! Oh, they hated McCarthy. They hated him worse than I did him. I mean, they. I hated him with. But he drank himself to death, and his name will not appear in the pages of history with anything but with hate. So, I don't know what else we can.
Do you think that? What effect do you think the election of McCarthy had on the Democrats?
Well, he had everybody scared. He had the people all scared to open their mouth, to admit that they were liberals, and he almost got the same thing now.
Well, I was wondering more along the lines. McCarthy was such an anathema to the very people that elected him that if he hadn't have been elected, they might have remained Republicans.
Yeah.
Do you think that's possible?
Well,
do you think that by being such a stigma on the party, the Republican Party, that he pushed that very event may have pushed people?
Pushed people out of the. I say it pushed the intellectuals and the honest. You know, I'd call the honest people looked at government from a sensible.
Mm-hmm. You were speaking specifically in '54. You felt that a lot of Republicans went over.
Well, '54 was the year when they had the big when they had the big hearings. It mm-hmm. didn't affect the '54 election as much as it did the '56. Mm-hmm. Then it started, and then of course. He died in May 1st, 1957.
Mm-hmm. Do you know any specific Republicans that made that switch?
Well, I know that like Lawrence Whitted, who is Speaker, Republican Speaker. He hated OE, and he was a kind of he's a nice guy, but he thought McCarthy was terrible. I can think of. Very close friend of mine who is Eugene R. McPhee. He was the head of the state. Teachers College, state universities then.
Mm-hmm.
And he hated. He was a Republican right through, but he hated McCarthy.
Mm-hmm.
He was a public servant that, but. First of all, he was honest. He was he believed in fair play, and I can think of other people because I came in contact, like through Kiwanis, you'd hear people.
Sure. Do you think these people just switched? Do you think they switched permanently to voting Democrat?
I think a lot of them. Felt that the Democratic Party wasn't as bad as they thought it was at one time. They were, see, we were in power 20, you know, the Democrats were in power 20 years. And we were to do anything to elect the Republican. And then when they saw this thing was going, the hearing he brought out was his defeat. He was absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a whole tape, a 2-hour record of all the highlights of the McCarthy hearings.
You do. Is this a tape that you made?
No, a friend of mine from WBBM gave it to me. I still have it. I think I got it on. It's on tape at WHA, and I think WIBA had a tape of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it gives. You were pretty young then, weren't you?
Oh, yeah. I didn't know anything about what was going on.
No, I say you were pretty young. You wouldn't.
Yeah,
I like to hear it once in a while. It's
4 or 5, 6 years old.
Yeah, well, These tapes, I just love to hear them once in a while.